Hello, and welcome back to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I don't even know that I said two different words there. The stories that define and refine us. I am here today with one of our Reshelving Alexandria Facebook moderators, Kimberly. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Would you like to introduce yourself? And you can include saying your last name if you would like. I just don't want to butcher it.
My last name is Schluterman. I tell people it's like shoe, but with an L in there.
Nice.
If you're curious, it's German and it used to mean like slaughter. So like the butcherer, I think. Mm-hmm. So my husband's ancestors, I think, were slaughterers of sorts.
Nice. Well, we're excited to have you here today, and we are going to talk about your reading journey. So do you want to start by letting us know three of your most influential or favorite books?
Well, can I just tell you first that this has caused quite a ruckus in my home?
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking about, I know you're going to ask me this, so I've been trying to prepare an answer, and I keep asking my husband, what has been the most influential? And the only answer he'll give me is Pride and Prejudice. And I'm like, it is definitely one of my favorites, but has it influenced me? He's like, I don't know. And then what I always respond with is, but don't they all? I feel like every book I read influences me. Mm-hmm. That's why we read books, is to be influenced so that you're changed. You're not the same after as you were before. And in that sense, I'm over here like, okay, so what is the most? Anyway, so I don't know. But I have my answers. They're just probably not great. I don't know if they're actually true.
Each book builds on itself too. So like if you read it 20 years ago and it wasn't very influential at that point, but now you have life experience and you read it now, it may influence you entirely differently.
I mean, it's true. And I assume we can't use the Bible as an answer, but that would of course be the answer, but I assume that's off the table. So for purposes of this question.
Yes.
So here are my answers, even though I don't think they're all together. I don't know how accurate they are. The first one I thought of, though, is originally called Rocket Boys. Today it's published as October Sky, and it's a movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. And I read it when I was in sixth grade. And I read it for school. I don't remember what the assignment was. And I really liked it. And I think part of it was because Homer, the autobiographer, more of a memoir than autobiography, he was a little older than me in the story. And so it was just kind of, we usually like the stories about people who are just a little ahead of us. But I would say it was influential, one, because it let me – I think it's the first book that I remember enjoying in the nonfiction genre, where I was already an avid reader of basically twaddle, although I didn't know to call it that at the time. But that was the first nonfiction that made me think, oh, real stories could be just as captivating as – imagined stories. And the other reason I would say it was so memorable is probably because it wasn't a memoir and he's a really good writer. I really felt like I was there with him. When I finished the book, I was sad. I mean, I think you call it a book hangover, and that was the first time I really remember having a book hangover of like, now what am I going to do with my life? So when the movie came out, I was so glad to see. I read it before the movie came out, and I was so glad to see that time period and that place. And I have since. And another reason I would say that it was influential is because then when I became a mom for the first time, when I was in those long nights and those long hours of breastfeeding, I didn't know what to read, and I didn't have a lot of books at the time, but one of the books that I had was October Sky. And I was like, you know, I enjoyed that, and that's been a long time. So I reread it, and it's the first book I ever remember rereading. And that then, after that, I was like, well, he has other memoirs. And so I read all of his other memoirs, and I enjoyed all of them almost as much. Wow. He actually also has fiction that I have not read. But anyway, so that's my first answer. They're not all this long. I guess I'm gonna say Pride and Prejudice, because for a similar reason, it was the first time I remember truly enjoying a classic. And it was also the first time it occurred to me that people of old had a sense of humor.
Yeah.
She's funny. And I didn't know she was going to be funny. No one told me, hey, Jane Austen's funny. Yeah. And it caught me off guard. And I was like, was that a joke? I think she just made a joke. And it was just such a revelation to me.
I think she's just a little bit sassy.
She is. She's so sassy. And it just didn't occur to me that people were sassy back then.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I was influenced so much as just informed. And the last one, I mean, we're just gonna be real honest here. I'm gonna say the very first Babysitter's Club, which I had to Google to get the name, and it is called Chrissy's Great Idea. Mm-hmm. I sure didn't remember that. But actually, I was a reluctant reader as a child. My parents were both avid readers, and they constantly wanted me to read. And I didn't wanna, probably because they read, and I thought that's not cool. And old then
thuggies.
Yeah. And then in class in third grade, we had a gift exchange and I was gifted a set, like the six book set of the first few Babysitter's Club books. And I was like, this is the lamest. I was so bummed out. Everyone else got really cool stuff. And I got these stupid books and I put them on the top shelf of my closet, never to think of them again. I never even took them out of the shrink wrap until one random night. By God's providence, I assume, I couldn't sleep. I was just restless and I couldn't sleep. And I remember laying in bed, looking across at my closet, and my eye went to the top. And it was middle of the night. Why could I see it? I don't know. It's not like I didn't sleep with lights. I don't know. But somehow I was like, you know, maybe I'm just bored enough to read a book.
Yeah.
And so I got these books down and I started reading. And I read that night for hours. And I picked it up the next day and I finished it and I read the next book and the next book. And that was the beginning of my love of reading, where nothing else, all the things my parents tried, nothing else did. But somehow Chrissy's Great Idea, it got me. And so I just read and I didn't stop again. I didn't stop reading until my public AP English education sucked all the joy right out of it.
Yeah.
And college has a lot of required reading, and it wasn't joyful. It wasn't fun. It was just another thing to do. And so, I don't know. I feel like it was very impactful because, and actually this is where I think we're going to go with the conversation more later. I had my entire childhood then was full of really, I'd say good books. It was a lot of twaddle, but some good books too. It was full of reading and a joy of reading. So that then later as an adult, I could fall back to that and say, well, I remember I used to enjoy this. I bet I could enjoy it again if. And then I just had to answer the if and find out, where do you go from here?
Yeah. So where did you go from here? What was your if?
It had to be my choice. Assigned reading was not probably going to get me there. And that probably tells you a lot about my personality. Not the best things probably, but I needed it to be, I was actually just having this conversation with someone else in a completely different context earlier today. Sometimes we need to start with something we're confident in. And so I had to start with something that was too easy, something. And I think that's why when I came back to it all these years later, I started with something that I'd already read. I already knew I enjoyed October Sky. I needed the confidence of saying, I know I enjoyed this once.
Yeah.
Maybe I can enjoy it again.
Yeah. That's really good. I like that. Yeah. I like what you had to say about it had, like, it couldn't be something that was assigned and something also that was easier for you than what your actual level was. And that's what I always come back to with parents who are like, my kid's an advanced reader. And they're 9, what should I have them read? And I say you should have them read books that are for 9-year-olds. Like, it doesn't matter if it's easier for them and not challenging them. They'll just read more. Yeah. They'll read more. They'll get context. They'll see people processing emotions at a level that is probably emotionally on level with where they are.
Right.
And I think that I'm probably just going to have my own therapy session here. That when people say that their kids are emotionally mature, oftentimes that just means that they've been exposed to more than they probably should have already. So why are we continuing that exposure? I think that emotionally mature kids probably are carrying more emotions than they know what to do with, and other people's emotions than they know what to do with. So we definitely should give them books that are on par with where they are at age-wise and developmentally, so that they can have other characters processing through these hard events with them, instead of just continuing to lay on, here's the hardness of life, and not really give them a path through it.
You know, I just realized about 3 seconds ago that the podcast cannot hear me nodding. Oh. But I am nodding enthusiastically. I agree with everything you just said.
That's funny. I saw October Sky in theaters as a kid with my dad, and I really enjoyed it. And so I'm very interested in his fiction. And I definitely didn't know that he wrote more about his life than just October Sky. But even just the movie was a really well-told story. So I can only imagine.
It was. And so I think there were two more memoirs. And one of them was also from his high school days. Mm-hmm. I wish I had a better long-term memory. And the other was when he was in college and he came home for a little while. Mm-hmm. And that one was slower for me to get into, but I remember it better, clearly, because the middle one, I'm struggling to even now to remember actually what part of his life it was. So it was a little bit of a slower start, but it was really good, because I could now I could tell you quite a bit about it if I wanted to.
So now, do you feel that you read a fairly even balance of fiction and nonfiction, or do you have a preference?
I would say balanced-ish. I mean, fiction is always, I mean, it's like eating dessert, you know. It's always nice and easy to eat a bowl of ice cream.
Yeah.
But it isn't really as fulfilling. And so sometimes I start to notice that I'm just burning through books and I wouldn't be able to narrate it even a month later. Mm. And maybe I'm enjoying it, but is that really the kind of reader I want to be? Is that the kind of human I want to be? Is that the kind of homeschooling mom is that what I want to model for my kids? And so when I start to notice that the stuff is just being, you know, processed too quickly or really not being processed at all, then I slow down and I try to pick something meatier. And nonfiction books abound in this house. It's not like I struggle to have options. But I really like biographies and autobiographies very much. Mm-hmm. I also really like micro history, you know, the book about like just one specific event.
Right.
My history education, I would just flatly say, was not great, where I got bits and pieces of things. And I remember in sixth grade talking about wars and battles that meant nothing. I had no context. I don't remember learning about ideologies.
Yeah.
I don't remember learning about reasons, and maybe it was there and I just forgot, but that's not anyway. So I just have bits and pieces, and I have only as a homeschooling mom begun to develop a big picture of history and begun to see how the different puzzle pieces fit together.
Yeah.
And so micro histories are fun because they let me kind of deep dive on something, but most micro histories, the good ones, will also give you a context in the beginning of the story. And so now I grab onto that context and I can know how to place it. And usually I'm reading about an event that I've heard about. I just didn't really understand it before. And so now first I'm starting with the context. I have a better foundation now for knowing what to do with it once I know the context. And then the event is explained and I'm like, oh, I actually understand this now. And that's a fun feeling.
Yeah, that's why I love all the picture book biographies
and
picture book history stories that have come out, is that's what they are. They're these micro history events, and they really just dive into something that you maybe got a paragraph if you were lucky in your high school history book or middle school history book when you were growing up. And this just gives you opportunity to explore it deeper and plop it into history at large. I do want to talk about a history book real quick that is not microhistory, because I need to do a correction from another podcast episode that we had recently. And then now that I finished the book, I want to just share more about it. So when I was talking with Lauren, I was talking about the book A Little History of the World that I absolutely adore. And I was at the end of it with my girls. And so we finished it now. And then we went back and we listened to the last chapter a second time. And I'm going to tell you why. So what I love about it is that it goes up until... So the author is writing this for kids, and it's a historical overview of the world up until when the book is done being written, which is after World War II. And so the author is talking about, and this is the correction that I have from that episode. I think that I said that he was from Germany. He was from Austria. And so he was an Austrian Jew who was relocated to Britain as things were getting dicey for Jewish people who were not getting moved out of Nazi-controlled areas. And so he spent his time in Britain during World War II translating all of the Nazi propaganda that was happening. So he was translating German news and propaganda for the British government. And so he had this very unique position of seeing the war from, of hearing the war from both sides, hearing it from the Allied side and also hearing it from the German side, because it was important for them to like not only know what just Germany was telling people at large, but like what the German people were believing. Mm-hmm. And what I really loved about the last chapter was that the author comes back and he's like, we need to talk about the chapter before this with World War One, where I told you about how World War One ended. Mm-hmm. And Germany and Austria and those guys' view on how the American president had not kept his word and that all this stuff had happened against them. And he said, what I told you, I thought was true as a kid in Austria, because that is what I had been told. And I figured you can trust what you've lived through and what you've been told. And he's like, but now as an adult who has experienced World War II and who has researched this, I now understand that we were lied to and that this was part of the German propaganda machine already in motion. But what I love about this last chapter so hard, Kimberly, and I would say if you think, oh, my kids are already past the reading level of this book, and not you, your kids are younger. But if someone listening to this were to think this is beneath us, we've already moved past this, I highly, highly, highly recommend that you grab the audiobook and listen to the last two chapters, even if that's all. Because one, I think that listening to a man say that he is wrong and that he was mistaken and make it right, that is something everyone should experience. And so that's why we listened to that last chapter twice, because I think it's so important for someone speaking from a position of authority, mm-hmm. which a historian is doing, to be able to say, I was wrong. And here's mm-hmm. how you can do this research for yourself. And this is why you shouldn't just believe everything that you hear. And this is why, like, I have done the best that I can not to mislead you, but there are possible places where I myself have been misled. And so you should do some reading for yourself. You should look into these situations also, and you should be aware how easy it is to have it done to you because it was done to me. And I just think that that is so valuable of a message in our country, where it is 100% legal for the government to lie to us. A lot of people don't realize that. that's legal. And so I think that it's important for people to see how this has played out in history with governments that are not looking into the best interest of their people and are definitely trying to sway their people one side or the other, just to help train our kids to be self-aware, to be aware of what's going on around them, to ask questions, not to not trust anybody, but to know that, you know, you are the final person responsible for what you believe. And yeah, dig in and get more than one side of a story.
Well, and how fascinating that he says, I thought I should be able to trust my own lived experience. Yeah. I think most of us would say that.
Yeah.
And I mean, in other contexts, I've spent a lot of time thinking about how different people can be in a conversation or in a situation. And clearly later in the conversations, you realize they experienced that same moment or that same conversation completely differently. They have completely different realities. They brought different things into the conversation, and so they got different things out. Yeah. And so for in that kind of situation, and when we think about relationships, so often our lived experience is also still not dependable, because we are always bringing our own framework into it.
Yeah.
What a fascinating.
Yeah, it's definitely something to like have good conversations with your teenagers about and from so many angles. So I just, if you don't have time to read the rest of it, just read the last two chapters of A Little History of the World.
Good to know.
And yeah. So I liked that you pointed out that you really liked Jane Austen's sense of humor. What other books have you liked for their sense of humor? Because we're always getting requests for books that'll make you laugh. And I think that's one, challenging because it's subjective in that different people have different types of senses of humor. But what's been funny for you?
That is true. So can I just tell you a funny story first?
Yeah.
Netflix has a movie called Love and Friendship, which is adapted from a Jane Austen story, I think, called Lady Susan. I've never read Lady Susan. I don't know. And I've started watching this multiple times and I never get far. So I haven't watched it. But it was on the other day and I was in the bathroom brushing my teeth and I was listening to it and I laughed. I laughed out loud. And my husband was in the bedroom where the TV was on. And I said, that was a joke. I said, that was funny. Jane Austen's making a joke. And he said, yes, but did the character make a joke or did Jane Austen make a joke? And I thought that was a really interesting question. And to his point, the character was not making a joke. The character was dead serious.
Yeah.
Very specifically, Jane Austen was making a joke to her audience that the characters in the story were completely oblivious to. So I don't know. I just thought that was hilarious. I'm definitely not an expert on this genre, but since you asked, I will tell you my answer. And when I was in college, I read a lot of Dave Barry and he made me laugh out loud. Mm-hmm. And I don't think is he still right? I don't know. He wrote a lot of books. There's a lot of them.
Read a lot.
But I definitely haven't read them all, but I remember laughing at the time. Honest to goodness, Elephant and Piggy books are laugh out loud funny. They make me laugh so hard. There's a Bird on Your Head. If you can read There's a Bird on Your Head out loud without laughing out loud, you need to ask yourself some hard questions. It's so funny. There's a lot of children's picture books that really are, I think it's easy for adults to overlook because they're picture books, but they're funny. The Mother Bruce book where he's like a bear and then their eggs are the ducks. Anyway, I don't even remember those details, but I remember it's funny. And I'll tell you one that we quote often in our house is I Said Goodnight Already. Do you know this one? Mm-mm. It's a little scholastic. So I'm sure it's at every book fair in America where it's a bear and his neighbor's a duck. And Bear's like, I just want to go to sleep. And Duck is like, hey, Bear, can I borrow? And he's like, leave me alone. Hey, Bear, can I? Leave me alone. I said goodnight already. And it escalates, I said goodnight already. And in our house, that's a very frequent line of, I said goodnight. And it's, our kids laugh and we laugh. Mm-hmm. And it's so fun to have a shared joke.
Yeah.
Because it's like an inside joke with your children. Another one, don't let the pigeon drive the bus.
Yeah.
That's also funny. Mo Willem. This is the same author as Elephant and Piggy, isn't it? He's funny. Mm-hmm. He's a funny guy. My kids read the Peanuts comics. Mm-hmm. And my oldest one, we'll send her to bed and she's upstairs. And we'll be in the living room watching TV and she cracks herself up. She is just laughing out loud in a room all by herself reading the old Peanuts. I mean like the ones from the 50s. Right, the old Peanuts comics. And she'll tell me about them later, and I'm going to be real honest. The jokes don't land on me very well. I'm like, I am really glad that you're laughing. I don't think I get it, but clearly I'm not the target audience. And I'm so grateful. Like you said, different people have different senses of humor. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes jokes for kids are funny to adults, and maybe sometimes they're not. Yeah. But and actually learning to appreciate picture books is – for adults is something that I've learned from you, where I don't think it would have occurred to me that picture books can be a blessing to adults. Like it just didn't,
yeah,
I just didn't know, but you talk about it often. And I'm so grateful for that influence because I have laughed a lot because of some of these children's books.
That makes me happy. Have you read Poultrygeist?
No.
So I am not usually one to appreciate books that are meant to be scary or spooky at all. But Poultrygeist just hits me in that spot. It's basically the story of why did the chicken cross the road? Except the chicken crossed the road and got flattened by a semi and is now a poultrygeist. And there's a whole bunch of other animals that are in their ghostly form that have not fared well crossing roads before. And they're like telling the poultry basically how to do things, and everything's going great for the poultry. And then he realizes that he can be scary too. And it just opens a whole new world. But seriously, my favorite page in that whole book is the end papers. Because some stories, the illustrator just continues the story after the story's over. So, like, the story's over. And then on the last page, you see a squirrel getting ready to cross the road. And you, the reader, can see a truck coming around the bend. It's a blind corner. And the squirrel doesn't see it. And you just know that that's, like, probably going to be the start. So it's, like, it's dark humor. Yes. And there's not a lot of that that's, like, appropriate in kids' right. books.
No, it's tricky.
But I feel that this one, it just handles it so well. But what you were saying about Peanuts, we actually had a thread in the Facebook group this week on Peanuts. One mom was looking for an alternative to the Peanuts because she didn't like, I think, the name calling, which I can appreciate. And her kid was a lot younger as well. But I just took the opportunity to share our experience with Peanuts, and I'll share it with you and everyone listening. Our oldest son is 11, and Knightley is on the spectrum and has a very hard time navigating social situations. If he even suspects that his siblings are laughing at him, he will just like start telling everybody like stop laughing at me. But the thing is, like, no one's laughing at him. We're laughing mm-hmm. at the humor of the situation, but there's no nuance for him right. in that type of situation. So we work really hard on social situations and what people may be thinking. And then last year we started working really hard on the concept of not everyone you know is your friend. And that's a hard one for little kids, especially if they watch any TV shows mm-hmm. where everybody's your friend and anyone you meet is your new friend and this is great. And little kids, you know, they go to the park and they leave and they've made a new best friend. And so he very much believed that all the kids at youth group on Wednesday nights were his friends. And then he was struggling with the fact that some of his friends were not very nice to him, but he didn't have the vocabulary or emotional wherewithal to explain everything that was happening. And middle grade girls can be incredibly mean, and they can do it under their breath so that other adults supervising don't know what's going on. And so it was after the last week of this school year that we found out that he had been definitely dealing with some bullying. And during this time, in like the last 2 months of that, I had given him and Everhart the Peanuts collections, those big hardcovers that they have like by year. And so he was reading those and he was just engrossed. And I'd offered them Peanuts a couple years ago and they hadn't landed, but they just loved Calvin and Hobbes. So they were just like on their Calvin and Hobbes focus for a few years. But Knightley was obsessed with these Peanuts books, and he would read through them. And I love how your daughter's laughing. I don't think Knightley's laughed at anything in the Peanuts. I don't think he thinks they're funny. I think that he truly believes that they are a nonfiction guide to human nature. And so he just will bring them to me and he will be like, okay, in this exchange and this situation, what is happening? Right. What do they mean when they say this? What is the subtext? I mean, he doesn't use the word subtext, but like, that would be so helpful if he did. What is the subtext of this exchange here, you know? And then he started processing through different experiences and aligning them with things he had learned from the Peanuts. Like, he just came to me one day, and this was before we really understood what was happening, and he was like, I figured out which character in Peanuts I would want to be. And I was like, sweet, like, who do you want to be? And he's like, Schroeder. And I thought, okay, that's very interesting, like, not who I would have thought he would want to be, but I was like, that's cool, like, why do you want to be Schroeder? And he's like, because Schroeder doesn't get upset when Lucy is bothering him. And he's able to focus on what is important to him. Kimberly, my son has taken up playing piano and is teaching himself to play by ear because he has decided he is Schroeder. And like,
that is Schroeder.
Shouldn't
we all?
Yes, I know. And he's had such, it's been so helpful being able to process through these girls who every time he walks into a room goes, here comes Mr. Weirdo, by being able to like say, they're Lucy. Like in his mind, he sees they are Lucy.
It gives him a category for the behavior.
Yes. And so we've had really good conversations about the fact that like in the comics, everybody's referred to as people's friends, but nobody gives Charlie Brown Valentine's and Lucy always pulls the football. And are these actually friends, or are these just people that you know and have to be around in social situations? And so you should choose to be kind because that's the control that you have over the situation. So that's just been so powerful. And I am so grateful to Peanuts for that.
You know, actually, so I recently bought, since my kids like the Peanuts so much, in the RA marketplace, I recently purchased a bunch of Garfield comics. And I intended them when I got them for my oldest, the avid Peanuts reader. And then my middle, my son, had a birthday. I was like, you know, he would like these too. Why not? So I gave them to him. And it was like Christmas in our house. They both of them just dived in and started just reading and reading and reading. And I remember watching the Garfield cartoon when I was a kid, and I loved it. And I was so nostalgic about it. And so now I'm going to pause and tell you about a different book, and I'm going to come back. Okay. There is a book that I'm trying to remember the name of, Cat and Dogs, Dogs and Cats, something. And it's about, it's like a book to help you talk to your children about behavior. And in the book, dogs are kind and cats are, or well, I think dogs are obedient and cats are something less than. Cats are just mean and kind of like, I mean, I love cats, but let's be real. They're just not, you know, dogs love their humans and cats tolerate them. Yeah. And And the cats in the book are just the example of what not to do.
Right.
So now coming back to Garfield, I just didn't think about the content because I was so nostalgic about it when I gave them to my kids. And then they start reading them. And I was like, oh, I didn't look at it before. I just gave it to you. He's so mean. Yeah, Garfield really is so mean. And I just didn't know. I didn't remember that. Mm-hmm. But it falls perfectly with the book about dogs and cats, which we read as a family years ago. Mm-hmm. And so my kids already have a spot for cats being mean and dogs being nice. And so Garfield's treatment of Odie just falls right in line. And it's so illustrative in that way. So it's a worthy tool.
That's funny. Because in our house, our frame of reference for what cats are is the picture book called Every Cat Has Asperger's or something like that. And as a family full of people on the spectrum, obviously, we just say autism instead of Asperger's when we read it. But like, so for us, we have this book, Every Cat Has Autism, and it's highly relatable.
Yes.
And we see it in our cats, and it helps us to like explain how we are. So I'm not sure how I would feel about a book that basically like, cats are the problem.
No. Maybe we'd be careful with some of those connections. But.
Oh, that's funny. So, Kimberly, I know that you have been participating in the reading challenges that we've been doing. And do you want to just tell us a little bit about that and maybe your reading journey at as large?
So I never even tried in previous years. This is the first year I've even made a go at it. And when January rolled around, I was like, okay, you know, I really want to. I love the RA community. I love what we're doing here. If I do like, but also 52 is so many. You can't be serious. That is so many. I have 3 kids. I homeschool. I run a business. You can't be serious. And I said, let's say 26. If I can do 26, we're going to call it a good day because that's still a lot compared to what I've been doing in this very busy season of mothering young children.
And just to throw it out there for anyone listening, we do have a 12 book challenge.
Yes, so you do.
It's not 52 or plus. But Kimberly doesn't like to be told what to do. So she wasn't going to do 12.
I looked at the 12 book challenge and honestly, you're right. That is where I started. I was going to do it, but I didn't like some of the categories as much as some of the ones that were on the 52. And so I said, well, I'll just make my own 26 book list and I'll pick the ones I like. Maybe because I don't like to be told what to do, but so I started and I just said, let's just see I am about 70-ish% of the way through the reading challenge. And we're over 70.
26 or the 52?
The 52.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is. I'm reluctant to agree with you being recorded, but I am going to agree with you. It is amazing. And what it signifies is a couple of things. One, it signifies that, well, also it's worth noting that we're more than 75% of the way through the year. So I'm still definitely behind in that sense. Mm-hmm. But one, it signifies the picture books are worthy. Because I definitely have some picture books on my list that took less than 10 minutes to read. And those book choices are not less than.
Not at all.
And two, it signifies that the love of reading compounds itself. Mm-hmm. And so as I read, I enjoy reading that much more. And most of the books I've enjoyed and some I haven't not enjoyed as much, but I was still glad to have read them. Mm-hmm. I was still improved for having read them, or I thought about something more than I would have. Yeah. Wasn't it Mark Twain who said that everyone wants to have read the classics, but no one wants to read the classics?
Yeah.
I relate to that a lot, but I definitely, well, and an example is the classics category. I asked you, Amber, what am I going to read? And you're like, well, what do you like? I said, Pride and Prejudice. And you said, I should read, what's the Jane Austen one you told me to read?
Sense and Sensibility?
No, Persuasion.
Persuasion.
You told me to read Persuasion. And I was really excited to read Persuasion, and I didn't love it. I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
Much. Maybe I did. But I'm really glad.
I admitted Persuasion because then I was like, oh, you and Amanda can talk about it because it's her favorite.
It's her favorite. Oh, I don't. I would need to ask why. Why?
Yeah. See, and that's a great conversation to have with people. When you know that they love something, it very often it's a great conversation because it's like sometimes it's a tiny thing. Yeah. Like it is a small thing in a book. Yeah. That really connects to their own story or to their own dreams and aspirations when they had read it. And that's why it's their favorite.
Yep.
And nobody else would connect to that, or almost no one else. Like, it's a very personal thing.
Well, there were definitely pieces of the story that I appreciated. But mm-hmm. did I enjoy the actual experience of reading the story? Definitely not like I did Pride and Prejudice, and not like I have other things. But I'm still glad to have read it. And so in that sense, the reading challenge has improved my reading level. I feel like I'm a stronger reader now than I was for having persisted.
Yeah.
And also my mind is that much bigger for having one more story put into it. I, you know, I said earlier that school as it was definitely sucked a lot of the joy out of reading for me. And so I went a lot of years where I read almost nothing except for like Facebook or whatever it was on my phone. And it was when my first was born, it was all those hours of nursing when I picked up Rocket Boys, October Sky.
Right.
And that was the first one, but it sure wasn't the last. And so I read then lots of books for a time while I was nursing. And then I had a 1 year old, and then 5 minutes later I was pregnant again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so sick when I'm pregnant, I can't even read. I get motion sickness. Yeah. And so there's another season of not reading. And then I had another baby. So, well, here's another season of reading. Mm-hmm. But he was a really hard baby. So I was so tired, and I just, so I'm reading, but then I'm not. And then life just happens really fast sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just are reacting and you're never getting ahead. You're just dealing with what's in front of you.
Survival mode.
Yeah. Yes. And the poem that Elizabeth Elliot made so famous, just do the next thing. I just spent a long time just doing the next thing. And the next thing was never reading for pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, praise God, we're in a gentler season. And I'm being deeply influenced by the RA community. Mm-hmm. And so, and I made reading a priority this year. That's really the biggest difference. I didn't wait for a season that made it attractive. I just said, let's do it. Just do it anyway. And I have gotten so much pleasure from the stories this year and the reading. And I am so grateful. And even honest, I might not get all 52 books. I might not make it. And if I don't, I'm still going to post in the group, and I'm going to still say, look, I came so far. And for me, for where I'm at, this is huge. I'm so, I progress, not perfection.
Yeah. We love celebrating personal victories, because I was very similar. I had Inara, and I was still able to read after her. Like, the last Harry Potter book came out, and Eric picked it up at the bookstore at midnight for me, and I had it read before I went to bed that night. And then I didn't read a lot after Inara. We were moving and it was pretty busy, and we had a miscarriage right away, and then we got pregnant with Gemma right after. But after Gemma, that started like a drought in my life, period, because my dad got sick and then he passed away, and we had Knightley, who was undiagnosed but was not easy, and there were a lot of things going on, and we didn't know what they were. And Gemma had not been a super easy baby either. And so when I have a new baby, during those late nursing nights that you're talking about, I read through all of Jane Austen's books on my phone, because they don't get my blood pumping.
Including Persuasion. And did you like it?
Including Persuasion. I do like Persuasion. I had to read it a couple times to really start to enjoy it. And I think that that's the way it is for most Jane Austen for me, because there's so much you don't understand. And I've said it before and I will say it again. If you try to read Sense and Sensibility and cannot get through the first chapter, I do not blame you. Go watch the movie and come back and read the book.
Yeah.
Because the first chapter of that book is about like the money system in England. And if you don't really comprehend what's going on, you don't see the value of, you don't see the importance of the different options that are being weighed, and you don't understand the nuances and the implications of what is determined. And so it's just kind of like, okay, I don't know these people and I don't care.
Right.
But if you understand the story and what the implications of these decisions are, then the conversation makes sense. And so I think that for me, there was a lot of that in reading all the Jane Austen's. I'd read them when I was a teenager. I just hadn't read them since then. So then when I started having kids, I was like, okay, I'm going to start reading these because they'll just be my, I think they were all free on Kindle. And so I was just reading through them on a loop. So for every kid, I've done that except Lily. But then after I had, and then I got a chronic illness after Inara as well. So after Everheart, I moved into a season of, I started taking CBD oil and it took my pain from an 11 down to a 3. And when you've been at an 11, as long as I have, a 3 just feels like nothing. And that's like totally, life is normal. And so I had my brain back. Like the brain fog was gone. I could think clearly. I wasn't spending all of my time disassociating and keeping the pain packed over in one corner. So I started reading again. And I found a book community on Facebook and felt like I had found my people and was really excited. And then started reshelving Alexandria specifically just to talk about book series and like complete author lists, because that was very interesting to me and someone that I had befriended in that group. And so started this group for that. And then that original book community that I was in that I like loved so much, they kicked me out because they thought that I had opened a competing group, which I had not, but I had opened a niche group. But then we were like, okay, I guess we got to expand what we're doing over here so that I can still have book people to talk to, because it brought life back to me.
Yes.
Like even just with the books, as a stay-at-home mom, it feels like talking to another adult.
Yeah, it's so true.
It really does. And so then we, we just opened up the conversation in Reshelving Alexandria to just good, true, and beautiful books. And we've never advertised the group. The group has just grown by people bringing their own friends and word of mouth. And it's, I love it. I love this community of book lovers and like-minded readers.
You know, I told you when we were texting about this that I was like, you know, I think my experience with journey through reading, I think is very relatable. But then I joked, but I'm not really joking, that relatable also means not unique and maybe not even all that interesting. I don't think my story is unique at all. I think it's very normal and common to have seasons when you enjoy reading and seasons when you want to read but can't, and seasons sometimes when you don't even want to. And I guess what I finally come to is that needs to be okay. And if you're in a season when you don't even want to, maybe don't beat yourself up. Maybe just wait and it will come. Maybe just take a break and it will come. I think if you, if the love is already in you, sometimes just seasons, and that's okay. I definitely beat myself up and I regret that. And if I go through another season, I don't want to do that again. I'll just say, you know what? I'm just taking a break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really true. And I think that's part of the value of the Facebook community, is it really helps you to not feel alone. Because I think what you were saying about how maybe this isn't so unique and maybe this isn't just you, but if you never talk to anybody,
right,
you might think it's just you. Right. You might think that you have a problem. You might think that you are the only one suffering in the way that you are or struggling in the way that you are. And so I think that finding like-minded people who have been through similar situations is just incredibly encouraging and validating. And even what I was saying about like books being the only other adult that I would talk to in some days, like the community has really helped in that and connecting with different people mm-hmm. and having them be an adult to talk to. Last year on Tuesday night dance nights, you and I would jump on Zoom and we would talk for like an hour and a half. Yes, and
longer.
That was because of this group. Yeah. Yep. 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And
I just missed dinner with my family. Group. It's okay. I'm yeah. talking to Amber.
You know, meeting people and being able to not feel so alone and not feel unheard and things like that. So I love that about our community because I know we aren't the only ones. I know that Charlessa isn't the only person with like Charlessa and Lauren and Liz with their little book reading group that they've started. I know there's a lot of people that have done that. And I want to encourage people, like if you are looking for your people, start a thread in RA, say, I want to read this book. Does anyone want to read it with me? And you also might just find a book buddy and that might be yeah. a beautiful thing for you.
Yeah, that's good.
So talking about these hard times, are there any tips that you have on self-care in wintering seasons that you do?
Again, I don't think my answers are incredibly unique, but I mean, I like to take a hot bath. Some mm-hmm. people don't. I need my skin to be pink when I get out. Yeah. It should be really hot. I like... To me, it helps me desensory, maybe is a better mm-hmm. way to say it, where I just kind of just, all the things are just not, just for a minute, the things are just not here. Just yeah. for a minute, it's just me and that's water. It. and sometimes I take a book and often I'll take my Kindle because it's waterproof. And then I end up not reading it. I bring it with good intentions and I end up I just close my eyes and I just sit. And I think there's a lot to be said for rest. And mm-hmm. It's also important, I think, to point out that I'm only able to do that because my husband is filling in the gaps. Mm-hmm. I can't do that with 3 kids at home and no husband there or yeah. some other helper there. Someone else has to be keeping the humans alive while I do right. that. And so I think that for me, I mean, I'm calling it self-care because it's the thing that I'm doing with that time, but it's also cared. I'm being cared for by someone who loves me because he's providing that time. I just really like to read when I'm reading is a kind of self-care. I think it's kind of a lame answer in this context, but it's the true answer. I think escapism is valid. Sometimes, and I think it's good just to go somewhere else for a little while and see how other people deal with their things. Maybe your protagonist is dealing with different adversity, but how are they dealing with whatever their adversity is? Who are the people in their life and who's talking to them and what are those people saying to them and how do they deal with those people? Sometimes just, and you're so right when you talk about the things that stories do. They just inform us. They define and refine us, just like you say. I think, I don't know. I want to give you answers like I do my nails because I bought one of those UV nail lamps so I could do my own gel nail polish. And I enjoy doing it like 5 times a year, but it's just not. I enjoy watercoloring a lot. That's something I got into during COVID. And it's, my favorite thing about watercoloring is that there is absolutely no part of my self-identity that is connected to my ability to do art. I'm not an artist. This is not part of who I am. So if I'm completely terrible at it, that's fine. It's not who, like, there's just, I'm not an artist. Of course I'm terrible at it. And And I'm just, in most things that we try to do, we do our best because we're doing it for a reason and we care about it. And so if we don't do a good job, we have feelings about that. Mm-hmm. And when I watercolor, I can do a terrible job and just laugh at myself because I don't have feelings about it because I'm not an artist. It's okay. Yeah. So I was maybe that's my answer. I'm an external processor here. You're seeing it. I think my answer, my best tip for self-care is to do something that you can be bad at and laugh.
Yeah.
Do something that doesn't actually matter to you.
Yeah. Who is it that says that there's no rule that says you have to be good at your hobbies?
Right? I don't know who said that, but I want to be their friend. That's wise.
It's super wise. I tell that to my kids all the time. I was like, just like you don't have to be good at something that you're learning to do, even after you've learned to do it, if you enjoy it, you still don't have to be good at it.
I don't remember anyone telling me that. I wish someone had been so explicit. And I'm sure my parents didn't know that I needed to be told. And probably most people don't. But I know I've put a lot of emotion into things that don't matter. And learning not to has been one of the most freeing, enlightening things that have, not enlightening, but lightening in the sense that it's lightening my load.
Right.
You know, just one of the best things that I've learned.
Yeah. Can I tell you my story about not being an artist, but with an artist soul? Yeah. So I've always felt like I have an artist soul. Like, I feel like I have a good eye. I just can't make things happen the way that I want them to.
All right.
And I can't draw, I can't paint, or I don't know. Sometimes people are like, don't say you can't, you just haven't tried hard enough. I have not tried hard enough and will never try hard enough to succeed in
these. You are not trained in those skills.
Yes.
You're not trained or practiced.
Like, they don't have to be trained or practiced.
Yeah.
My Aunt Gloris, who was on the podcast, and she does book covers and illustrations for Living Book Press. She has been this beautiful artist my whole life. My mother, her sister, can just sit there and doodle during the church sermon and like completely copy the painting that she brought a little, you know, like the greeting card. Like, she would have a greeting card that someone sent her and she would just draw the whole thing and it looks like it. It looks like the thing she was drawing.
I can't
now
do that.
Now it's black and white because it's a pen. And Gemma, when Gemma was little, Gemma did not want to draw at all because she's a sweet little perfectionist and she would make me draw anything. If I was like, hey, you should color, she'd be like, yes. And then she'd be like, come color with me. And then I'd have to sit there and do the coloring and she would watch until she was 4, I think, at which point she just picked up a pen and could do it. Like, all of a sudden she was doing full pictures, corner to corner of a page, filling in every piece of the piece. And now she's like every piece of the paper with something artistic. And now she is this beautiful little artist. So
I'm trying really hard not to be jealous, but I have not been
able to do anything. And Inara, who I thought was going to be like me because, like, she was definitely not great when she was little, has improved over time greatly and is so much better than me. And I'm happy for all of them. But I like to do terrible little sketches of what I would like done and give them to someone and say, this is what I would like it to look like. And then it looks like that. And it's amazing. Yeah. Like, some of the art that we had before and then the logo that we have for our new publishing company for Reshelving Alexandria. Like, I had a huge part in the design element of that. And then the people who are gifted at making it happen made it happen. But my one moment that made me really happy was in our house. So we had the house fire. And my brain burnt out and Eric got me Animal Crossing to play to rest my brain. And he says that it was watching all the little homes that I was designing on Animal Crossing that gave him the confidence to just be like, yeah, do whatever you need to do on designing the interior of our home as it's being rebuilt. Like, he had a choice. So I did that. And I just did like what I wanted. And I wanted a house that was a cross between Art Deco and Hollywood Regency. So tons of like bright gold, clear lines, things that I love, like Frank Lloyd Wright, all those nice straight lines and squared corners, right? But none of our walls are white in this house. Even our main living space is called like cyber gray or something. It's like so gray. The first time I walked into it, I started crying because we had no electricity in the house. They had just painted. It was dark out. And I walked in and I thought the whole thing was black like a cave. And what had I decided? And I had completely misread this situation. And then the next morning I came over again and I was like, no, this is exactly what I wanted. So either way, we get the house put back together and we move in. And then it's that final inspection where the city comes through and values your house or whatever and make sure that you actually have all your electricity and plumbing working so that they can say it's okay for you to live there, even though you already are. So we were at that step. And Eric came downstairs and he's like, yeah, this lady was quite impressed. And she kept just oohing and aahing over all the color choices and all the design elements. And finally at the end, she was like, your wife's an artist, isn't she? And I was like, yes, I am. And I finally feel like my walls and my palette. And I didn't actually have to do the work. I just, you know, signed off on the sheets that said, do this, paint this wall this color and this wall that color. And it all worked out. So
nice.
So yes, I just smile and look at my walls and tell myself, I am an artist.
You are an artist. You're an artist in your soul.
Exactly.
My grandmother was a professional artist in New Orleans.
Nice.
Back in the, let's say probably like the 40s-ish, I think. Yeah. And after. And then later they moved to outside St. Louis. But she was just incredibly talented. And I don't know how much formal training she had. I think she was just one of those native talents. And I don't get it. I didn't get that. But it's fine. Everything's fine. I can just be terrible at this, but it's fine.
Well, thanks for coming, Kimberly, and talking to us about your reading journey and sharing some
thanks
fun
for having me. You said you were going to ask me another question. And I was really excited about it.
I was going to ask you another question. So my other question is, do you have any unpopular opinions when it comes to books? And of course, this would be the question you would want me to not skip.
I definitely texted Charlessa. I was like, how honest am I supposed to be here? I don't know what to say. So I have my answer for the podcast. and an answer that you can edit out if we'll see.
Sounds good.
So the easy answer for me is probably, I mean, it is, I guess unpopular means what it means. There's a whole category of books for babies and toddlers for like engineering. Mm-hmm. And the classic novels, like the classic Jane Austen's and the classic Charles Dickens.
They're called baby lit.
I don't like them. I actively dislike them. If they're in your home and you love them, good for you. We can still be friends. It is okay. But I don't like them.
We're not required to like all good things.
We are not. We can have those differences. And I am really glad that – I'm so glad the world is full of diverse people. We should not all be like me. I think one of me is quite enough. But but I just – every time I look at them, I just think, but why? But why? Just wait until they can appreciate Pride and Prejudice for real.
Yeah. Is that a real question? Because I can but why you. I can answer it.
Of course you can.
Because this one specifically is actually an unpopular
opinion. Am I stepping on your toes, Amber?
No. You're not. I think it's a good question because you are definitely not the only person with this opinion. This is one that does come up in the Facebook group fairly cyclically. Like once a season, someone will come out and be like, I don't like those books either. But this is what I think is the value of the books. One, I think that the books are not for the children. They're for the mothers.
I agree.
And so if you are looking for a gift for someone's baby and you know that they like a specific hobby, right, you try to find a tie-in. So people get onesies that have somebody's sports team on them, or my brother-in-law got a stroller that was Jeep brand, like things of this nature. But if your friend loves literature, then you get them the little pretty Pride and Prejudice book that just says, I see you and I know you and what you love, and I want to love your baby with you through that thing you love. That is the emotional connection value of those books. Beyond that, I think that these books also have this small similarity to The Childhood of Famous American Biographies. Those are gateway biographies, and they are so that when kids are older and they meet these characters again in history or deeper biographies, they're friends. They met them as a child. They knew who they were. They're familiar to them. And so they want to level up in their knowledge about that person. They want to know more about them. One of the things that I respect about the Baby Lit books is that they are not full of spoilers. So my mom got my daughter's, she just found this stack of coloring books at a garage sale that were literature based. I didn't think to look through them. Gave them to my kids. One of them was Little Women. My children now know who does not make it out of that book alive from the coloring book.
Oh,
and
no.
That was like, that was kind of shocking to them because they were getting ready to read that book. They were familiar enough with like who was in it. And they were like, I didn't know this was happening. And so I appreciate the Baby Lit books that they introduce you to the characters without telling you what's going to happen and spoiling it for you, and just making them like, cheerio, little friends. And really, it's a gift that says, I see you. I was an adult before some other people who had been adults in my life and had given me gifts most of my life gave me a gift that made me feel like they saw me and actually like knew who I was. And it made me cry. It was this wallet that like had the recycling symbol on it. So like they didn't even really get who I was, but I was starting my journey into like natural cleaners and taking care of what we were bringing into our home and putting around our kids. And we were cleaning up our diet and all of these things. And so like when they gave me that, I knew that they were trying to connect with me and what I was interested in. And so I feel like this is something where it's like, oh, I think she's already going to get 100 onesies. What more does this baby need? Well, she, the mother, might enjoy this book. And so it's an emotional connectivity gift more than it's actual literature for the child. So that's my take on those. But
fine.
I understand why.
I can concede there are merits.
I understand why some people are like, these are terrible literature. They're not literature, people. These are emotional connections that say, I see you. It's not literature. I don't think even the people making them are claiming that they're literature.
Well, I'm reluctant to tell you my second unpopular opinion.
Do it. Tell me your other unpopular opinion.
But I'm genuinely a little concerned that we might not be friends anymore.
You know what? As long as you aren't about to say that you hate Three Knocks on the Wall.
It is not Three Knocks.
Okay, go for it then.
It is another one of your very favorites.
That's okay.
And it is wildly adored in the RA group. I might get kicked out of the group. I might lose my moderator card.
Go for it.
I still don't know what to do. I don't even know how to process. I'm still Keeper of the Bees. I'm not sure I can say I like it.
That's okay.
I didn't enjoy the reading of it. Mm-hmm. Now looking back on it, I'm asking, but do I enjoy the story now that I'm not actively, like, sometimes like Persuasion, I like the story. I just didn't enjoy the reading of the story. And I'm asking myself, do I like the story? And I don't know. I think maybe I don't know. That is an interesting, and what I'll say of it is I've never encountered any other story like it, except there's one aspect of it that I texted you at the time. I said, this reminds me of Bargain Bride, But other than that one aspect of it in the beginning, there was, it's one of the most original stories I've ever heard. And so I like that about it.
Yeah.
But
I will say this for it. The first time that I read it, I was reading it aloud to the girls who were way too young for it, but I was doing after school care for the neighbor boys who were 9 and 11 at the time. And they were incredibly misbehaved young men, and they did not have any foundation of anything good, true, and beautiful. They had been adopted out of an incredibly graphically abusive family when they were like 2 and 4, and they had a single mom who was over her head now when we knew them. And so I started reading this book because I was interested in it, and I did not think they would be interested. And I really, it was just a, I'll read it this afternoon and then we'll pick up a different book tomorrow. They were fascinated by it in a way I had zero expectation that they would be.
Had you read it before? No,
I had not read it before. I didn't know what was going to happen or anything. And it has such a slow start.
Yes.
And just like in literally the first chapter, which is all we read the first day, there's no dialogue, nothing. I had zero reason to think that they
would be like, that's exactly what I said when I read it. I said that entire chapter, not one word of dialogue.
Yeah. And so I don't know what it was about that story that captivated people, like what you were saying about how it's so unique. Like, I don't know what it was about this that had the ability to pull people in.
To grab them,
That you would not. Yeah, that you, I wasn't even hooked yet. And they were like back the next day, like, all right, you know, Miss Amber, let's read the next page. And
it definitely picked up after I got through the first half, and after some key plot points, it definitely, the last third or half of it, I definitely, it went much faster. And what I finally came to, what I think is true, is I think that's one of those stories where you are in your life coming into it matters a lot. I think for some seasons and some situations, that's a story that, and I think from what you've said, I think it's probably true for you. I think it hit you at a time when you were, I think it met some needs for you. And I think maybe I read it for the reading challenge. I read it because Amber loves it. And I loved Bargain Bride, and Amber loves Bargain Bride. And so and you've made lots of great suggestions to me personally that I've really enjoyed. And I think I just was in a different season going into it where it just, it landed differently for me. But I would not ever say it's universally a bad book. It just, you know, we're just different and it hit me differently. But I, you can just edit this whole part out if you need to.
No, I'm going to keep it.
I mean,
we're going on the record, my friend. No, I think it's a really good point. I think it does come back around to what we were talking about earlier about how like little nuggets of something can really connect to different people. And I think that from the reviews that I've heard in the Facebook group, because like you said, so many people love this book. A few haven't been like hooked the way everyone else has, but almost universally this book is loved in the group, is everyone focuses on something different, which is fascinating to me. And so I feel that this book does have a lot of different things to offer, especially people in healing seasons.
Yes.
And so I think it really connects to people there. But the other thing that I just love about Jean Stratton Porter is how ahead of her time she was.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I believe firmly that in all of her research and observation and talking to people, she believed things that people knew generationally that had not yet had an official scientific study attached to it. And I think that that's a good thing to point out to our kids is
referring to some of the healthy living habits.
Some of the healthy living habits, but even just the aspect of the bees themselves. I was talking with Eric about this earlier this summer because I had read this article that was talking about how they are now using beekeeping as therapy for men with PTSD. And who is Jamie in this book? He's a man with PTSD. He's a man with all of these post-war traumas, medical, mental, emotional, and he's around bees. And we now know that, like, the frequency that bees emit their noise after they've come back from...
It's healing.
Flowers is healing. And so that's literally what's happening in this book. It's also, you know, the salt water therapy and the healthy food. But I mean, the man is literally tending bees and being made calmer and healed from it. And now we're seeing that to be true. Well, clearly people have known that for generations. And she believed it and she put it in her story. And so I use these types of situations with my kids to be like, there is a lot to say for personal experience because everyone's bodies are different. Everyone's experiences are different. And so if it worked for someone, it doesn't mean that it's not true because there's no scientific study to prove it. It may be something worth trying. Right. It may be something that will work for people that happen to have that genetic makeup and that list of personal experiences. And it may not be something that even could be replicated in a study because it's unique to... that genome type.
That physiology. Well, you recommended it for the Psalm 23 category. And I think it's perfect for that category. And I have struggled to think of any other story I know of that would fit it better. At least in the aspect of Psalm 23 that I wanted to get to. Like the kind of healing and the gentle. Because I wanted that aspect of Psalm 23. And it's, I mean, that part of it is just really beautifully done.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad that you brought that up. So again, when you're looking at it through, like, which lens are you looking at it through? So I don't know which part of Psalm 23 you were looking at it, but I felt that each character in that book had a different aspect of Psalm 23 playing out for them. And that the out of wedlock pregnant woman that... we get to see the whole, thou hast prepared a table for me in the presence of mine enemies. Like, she's literally having this moment where she's choosing life or death for herself. And you don't get more in the presence of mine enemies than that.
Yeah.
And there's this spiritual battle happening in that scene that is so powerful. And so... you know, I doubt that's the verse a lot of people are picking out when they're like, oh yeah, this is Amber's Psalm 23 pick. Like, they're probably thinking the still waters and restores my soul and all that. But I was just like, that moment's so powerful for me in, I mean, that's a valley of the shadow of death. That's, you know,
and it's also worth pointing out though, and I'm glad you said all that, because it's worth pointing out that I don't want to give spoilers, but there are some things in my life that made some parts of the plot particularly painful for me right now. Some things that I'm going through personally, where if I were not already grieving and having great big feelings of my own, some things wouldn't have re-hurt me. Like, it hurt me again to live through this with the characters, I don't think that's how I was meant to feel. I think I was meant to focus on the parts that you were just describing, but I was distracted from those things because I was dealing with my own feelings that were evoked, that were part of the story, but not really the main part of the story.
Right.
So there again, what you bring into it matters a lot.
Yeah.
So it, and that shouldn't take away from the story. It just means, and maybe if I read it again in 10 years, I might love it the way you do.
So much seasonality.
Yes.
Directed. So, yeah. Well, I'm glad you reminded me to ask you that question.
I'm not so kicked out of the group yet.
Yes. No, you can stay. We won't revoke your card.
Thank you. You're generous and gracious and kind as ever.
Oh, man. So all these books that we discussed will be in the show notes. And Kimberly, your homework is to remember what the name of that dog and cat
book I'll find it in the show notes. I also, like, as we're talking, I'm like, you know, and here I don't think I ever once mentioned, because the question was your influential books. I mean, some of my very favorites didn't even get mentioned at all. So I just want them to make the show notes. So I'm just going to throw it out there.
Do it.
Shepherd of the Hills by Harold Bell Wright is just so lovely. And it would be another Psalm 23 story, I think, although it would check some other category boxes as well. And obviously, if you haven't read Narnia, I don't know what you're waiting for. Chronicles of Narnia is one that I've read multiple times. I read first time when I was in college and I didn't know anything about it. And I don't know how I got to college without knowing anything about it, but I didn't. And I missed so much of the allegory. And I just kind of had a sense of, huh, that feels a little allegorical. And then I read the whole series again later as a mom, now knowing a lot more of, oh, it actually isn't. And it hit me really differently, but no less lovely for already knowing some of the mysteries.
Now I might take your membership card away. Chronicles of Narnia is not an allegory. Lewis says this multiple times.
I don't care what he says.
It has echoes.
He also said it didn't matter.
The true story.
Okay, but he also said it didn't matter what order you read it in, and we know he was wrong about that. He just didn't know what he had, Amber. He was too close to it. He had tunnel vision.
Oh my goodness. I have serious issues with Chronicles of Narnia if they are allegorical, because
I'm not saying it's a perfect allegory.
It has some massive theological issues.
I agree with what you said.
Story,
I agree. Then allegorical echoes. I will adjust. I agree. It's allegorical echoes, but nonetheless, it is a constant refrain in my mind that he is not a tame lion.
Yeah.
But he is good.
Yeah.
And that is something that I hope is in my mind always. Mm-hmm. And when I'm an old lady and I don't even recognize my own grandchildren, I just want to be able to tell a stranger he's not a tame lion, but he is good.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, that's a great way to wrap it up. All these books will be in the show notes. We're so glad to have you here, Kimberly, and we will definitely have you back.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Remember, everyone, that the stories are truer than true.